We'll explore another likely route in Chapter 7. But his findings are powerful in part because they confirm what we've sensed all along. Some of Kagan's studies even venture into the realm of cultural myth. For example, he believes, based on his data, that high reactivity is associated with physical traits, such as blue eyes, allergies, and hay fever, and that high reactive men are more likely than others to have a thin body and narrow face. Such conclusions are speculative and call to mind the 19th century practice of divining a man's soul from the shape of his skull. But whether or not they turn out to be accurate, it's interesting that these are just the physical characteristics we give fictional characters when we want to suggest that they're quiet, introverted, cerebral. It's as if these physiological tendencies are buried deep in our cultural unconscious. Take Disney movies, for example. Kagan and his colleagues speculate that Disney animators unconsciously understood high reactivity when they drew sensitive figures like Cinderella, Pinocchio, and Dopey with blue eyes, and brasher characters like Cinderella's stepsisters, Grumpy and Peter Pan with darker eyes. In many books, Hollywood films, and TV shows, too, the stock character of a reedy, nose-blowing young man is shorthand for the hapless but thoughtful kid who gets good grades, is a bit overwhelmed by the social whirl, and is talented at introspective activities like poetry or astrophysics. Think Ethan Hawke in Dead Poets Society. Kagan even speculates that some men prefer women with fair skin and blue eyes because they unconsciously code them as sensitive. Other studies of personality also support the premise that extroversion and introversion are physiologically, even genetically, based. One of the most common ways of untangling nature from nurture is to compare the personality traits of identical and fraternal twins. Identical twins develop from a single fertilized egg and therefore have exactly the same genes, while fraternal twins come from separate eggs and share only 50% of their genes on average. So if you measure introversion or extroversion levels in pairs of twins and find more correlation in identical twins than in fraternal pairs, which scientists do in study after study, even of twins raised in separate households, you can reasonably conclude that the trait has some genetic basis. None of these studies is perfect, but the results have consistently suggested that introversion and extroversion, like other major personality traits, such as agreeableness and conscientiousness, are about 40 to 50% heritable. But are biological explanations for introversion wholly satisfying? When I first read Kagan's book, Galen's Prophecy, I was so excited that I couldn't sleep. Here, inside these pages, were my friends, my family, myself, all of humanity, in fact, neatly sorted through the prism of a quiescent nervous system versus a reactive one. It was as if centuries of philosophical inquiry into the mystery of human personality had led to this shining moment of scientific clarity. There was an easy answer to the nature-nurture question after all. We are born with prepackaged temperaments that powerfully shape our adult personalities. But it couldn't be that simple, could it? Can we really reduce an introverted or extroverted personality to the nervous system its owner was born with? I would guess that I inherited a high reactive nervous system, but my mother insists I was an easy baby, not the kind to kick and wail over a popped balloon. I'm prone to wild flights of self-doubt, but I also have a deep well of courage in my own convictions. I feel horribly uncomfortable on my first day in a foreign city, but I love to travel. I was shy as a child, but have outgrown the worst of it. Furthermore, I don't think these contradictions are so unusual. Many people have dissonant aspects to their personalities, and people change profoundly over time, don't they? What about free will? Do we have no control over who we are and whom we become? I decided to track down Professor Kagan to ask him these questions in person. I felt drawn to him not only because his research findings were so compelling, but also because of what he represents in the great nature-nurture debate. He'd launched his career in 1954 staunchly on the side of nurture, a view in step with the scientific establishment of the day. Back then, The idea of inborn temperament was political dynamite, evoking the specter of Nazi eugenics and white supremacism. By contrast, the notion of children as blank slates for whom anything was possible appealed to a nation built on democracy. But Kagan had changed his mind along the way. "I have been dragged, kicking and screaming, by my data," he says now, "to acknowledge that temperament is more powerful than I thought and wish to believe." The publication of his early findings on high-reactive children in Science magazine in 1988 helped to legitimize the idea of inborn temperament, partly because his nurturist reputation was so strong. "If anyone could help me untangle the nature-nurture question," I hoped, it was Jerry Kagan. Kagan ushers me inside his office in Harvard's William James Hall, surveying me unblinkingly as I sit down, not unkind, but definitely discerning. I had imagined him as a gentle, white lab-coated scientist in a cartoon, pouring chemicals from one test tube to another until, poof, now, Susan, you know exactly who you are. But this isn't the mild-mannered old professor I'd imagined. Ironically, for a scientist whose books are infused with humanism and who describes himself as having been an anxious, easily frightened boy, I find him downright intimidating. I kick off our interview by asking a background question whose premise he disagrees with. "No, no, no," he thunders, as if I weren't sitting just across from him. The high-reactive side of my personality kicks into full gear. I'm always soft-spoken, but now I have to force my voice to come out louder than a whisper. On the tape recording of our conversation, Kagan's voice sounds booming and declamatory, mine much quieter. I'm aware that I'm holding my torso tensely, one of the telltale signs of the high-reactive. It feels strange to know that Kagan must be observing this, too. He says as much, nodding at me as he notes that many high-reactives become writers or pick other intellectual vocations where you're in charge, you close the door, pull down the shades and do your work. You're protected from encountering unexpected things. Those from less educated backgrounds tend to become file clerks and truck drivers, he says, for the same reasons. I mention a little girl I know who is slow to warm up. She studies new people rather than greeting them. Her family goes to the beach every weekend, but it takes her ages to dip a toe into the surf. "A classic high reactive," I remark. "No," Kagan exclaims. "Every behavior has more than one cause. Don't ever forget that. For every child who's slow to warm up, yes, there will be statistically more high reactives. But you can be slow to warm up because of how you spent the first 3.5 years of your life." When writers and journalists talk, they want to see a one-to-one relationship, one behavior, one cause. But it's really important that you see, for behaviors like slow to warm up, shyness, impulsivity, there are many roots to that. He reels off examples of environmental factors that could produce an introverted personality independently of or in concert with a reactive nervous system. A child might enjoy having new ideas about the world, say, so she spends a lot of time inside her head. Or health problems might direct a child inward to what's going on inside his body. My fear of public speaking might be equally complex. Do I dread it because I'm a high-reactive introvert? Maybe not. Some high-reactives love public speaking and performing, and plenty of extroverts have stage fright. Public speaking is the number one fear in America. Far more common than the fear of death. Public speaking phobia has many causes, including early childhood setbacks that have to do with our unique personal histories, not inborn temperament. In fact, public speaking anxiety may be primal and quintessentially human, not limited to those of us born with a high-reactive nervous system. One theory, based on the writings of the sociobiologist E.O. Wilson, holds that when our ancestors lived on the savannah, being watched intently meant only one thing. A wild animal was stalking us. And when we think we're about to be eaten, do we stand tall and hold forth confidently? No, we run. In other words, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution urge us to get the hell off the stage where we can mistake the gaze of the spectators for the glint in a predator's eye. Yet the audience expects not only that we'll stay put, but that we'll act relaxed and assured. This conflict between biology and protocol is one reason that speechmaking can be so fraught. It's also why exhortations to imagine the audience in the nude don't help nervous speakers. Naked lions are just as dangerous as elegantly dressed ones. But even though all human beings may be prone to mistaking audience members for predators, each of us has a different threshold for triggering the fight-or-flight response. How threateningly must the eyes of the audience members narrow before you feel they're about to pounce? Does it happen before you've even stepped on stage? Or does it take a few really good hecklers to trigger that adrenaline rush? You can see how a highly sensitive amygdala would make you more susceptible to frowns and bored sighs and people who check their BlackBerries while you're mid-sentence. And indeed, studies do show that introverts are significantly more likely than extroverts to fear public speaking. Kagan tells me about the time he watched a fellow scientist give a wonderful talk at a conference. Afterward, the speaker asked if they could have lunch. Kagan agreed, and the scientist proceeded to tell him that he gives lectures every month and, despite his capable stage persona, is terrified each time. Reading Kagan's work had had a big impact on him, however. "You changed my life," he told Kagan. "All this time I've been blaming my mother, but now I think I'm a high reactive." So am I introverted because I inherited my parents' high reactivity, copied their behaviors, or both? Remember that the heritability statistics derived from twin studies show that introversion-extroversion is only 40% to 50% heritable. This means that, in a group of people, on average half of the variability in introversion-extroversion is caused by genetic factors. To make things even more complex, there are probably many genes at work. And Kagan's framework of high reactivity is likely one of many physiological routes to introversion. Also, averages are tricky. A heritability rate of 50% doesn't necessarily mean that my introversion is 50% inherited from my parents, or that half of the difference in extroversion between my best friend and me is genetic. 100% of my introversion might come from genes, or none at all. Or more likely, some unfathomable combination of genes and experience. To ask whether it's nature or nurture, says Kagan, is like asking whether a blizzard is caused by temperature or humidity. It's the intricate interaction between the two that makes us who we are. So perhaps I've been asking the wrong question. Maybe the mystery of what percent of personality is nature and what percent nurture is less important than the question of how your inborn temperament interacts with the environment and with your own free will. To what degree is temperament destiny? On the one hand, according to the theory of gene-environment interaction, people who inherit certain traits tend to seek out life experiences that reinforce those characteristics. The most low-reactive kids, for example, court danger from the time they're toddlers, so that by the time they grow up, they don't bat an eye at grown-up-sized risks. They climb a few fences, become desensitized, and climb up on the roof. The late psychologist David Licken once explained in an Atlantic article. They'll have all sorts of experiences that other kids won't. Chuck Yeager, the first pilot to break the sound barrier, could step down from the belly of the bomber into the rocket ship and push the button, not because he was born with that difference between him and me, but because for the previous 30 years, his temperament impelled him to work his way up from climbing trees through increasing degrees of danger and excitement. Conversely, high reactive children may be more likely to develop into artists and writers and scientists and thinkers because their aversion to novelty causes them to spend time inside the familiar and intellectually fertile environment of their own heads. The university is filled with introverts, observes the psychologist Jerry Miller, director of the Center for the Child and the Family at the University of Michigan. The stereotype of the university professor is accurate for so many people on campus. They like to read. For them, there's nothing more exciting than ideas. And some of this has to do with how they spent their time when they were growing up. If you spend a lot of time charging around, then you have less time for reading and learning. There's only so much time in your life. On the other hand, there's also a wide range of possible outcomes for each temperament. Low-reactive, extroverted children, if raised by attentive families in safe environments, can grow up to be energetic achievers with big personalities, the Richard Bransons and Oprahs of the world. But give those same children negligent caregivers or a bad neighborhood, say some psychologists, and they can turn into bullies, juvenile delinquents, or criminals. Licken has controversially called psychopaths and heroes twigs on the same genetic branch. Consider the mechanism by which kids acquire their sense of right and wrong. Many psychologists believe that children develop a conscience when they do something inappropriate and are rebuked by their caregivers. Disapproval makes them feel anxious, and since anxiety is unpleasant, they learn to steer clear of antisocial behavior. This is known as internalizing their parents' standards of conduct, and its core is anxiety. But what if some kids are less prone to anxiety than others, as is true of extremely low-reactive kids? Often the best way to teach these children values is to give them positive role models and to channel their fearlessness into productive activities. A low-reactive child on an ice hockey team enjoys his peers' esteem when he charges at his opponents with a lowered shoulder, which is a legal move. But if he goes too far, raises his elbow, and gives another guy a concussion, he lands in the penalty box. Over time, he learns to use his appetite for risk and assertiveness wisely. Now imagine this same child growing up in a dangerous neighborhood with few organized sports or other constructive channels for his boldness. You can see how he might fall into delinquency. It may be that some disadvantaged kids who get into trouble suffer not solely from poverty or neglect, say those who hold this view, but also from the tragedy of a bold and exuberant temperament deprived of healthy outlets. The destinies of the most high-reactive kids are also influenced by the world around them, perhaps even more so than for the average child, according to a groundbreaking new theory dubbed the Orchid Hypothesis by David Dobbs in a wonderful article in The Atlantic. This theory holds that many children are like dandelions, able to thrive in just about any environment. But others, including the high-reactive types that Kagan studied, are more like orchids. They wilt easily, but under the right conditions can grow strong and magnificent. According to Jay Belsky, a leading proponent of this view, and a psychology professor and child care expert at the University of London, the reactivity of these kids' nervous systems makes them quickly overwhelmed by childhood adversity, but also able to benefit from a nurturing environment more than other children do. In other words, orchid children are more strongly affected by all experience, both positive and negative. Scientists have known for a while that high-reactive temperaments come with risk factors. These kids are especially vulnerable to challenges like marital tension, a parent's death, or abuse. They're more likely than their peers to react to these events with depression, anxiety, and shyness. Indeed, about a quarter of Kagan's high-reactive kids suffer from some degree of the condition known as social anxiety disorder, a chronic and disabling form of shyness. What scientists haven't realized until recently is that these risk factors have an upside. In other words, the sensitivities and the strengths are a package deal. High-reactive kids who enjoy good parenting, childcare, and a stable home environment tend to have fewer emotional problems and more social skills than their lower-reactive peers, studies show. Often they're exceedingly empathic, caring, and cooperative. They work well with others. They are kind, conscientious, and easily disturbed by cruelty, injustice, and irresponsibility. They're successful at the things that matter to them. They don't necessarily turn into class presidents or stars of the school play, Belsky told me, though this can happen too. For some, it's becoming the leader of their class. For others, it takes the form of doing well academically or being well-liked. The upsides of the high-reactive temperament have been documented in exciting research that scientists are only now beginning to pull together. One of the most interesting findings, also reported in Dobbs Atlantic article, comes from the world of rhesus monkeys, a species that shares about 95% of its DNA with humans and has elaborate social structures that resemble our own. In these monkeys, as well as in humans, a gene known as the serotonin transporter, SERT gene, or 5-HTTLPR, helps to regulate the processing of serotonin, a neurotransmitter that affects mood. A particular variation or allele of this gene, sometimes referred to as the short allele, is thought to be associated with high reactivity and introversion, as well as a heightened risk of depression in humans who have had difficult lives. When baby monkeys with a similar allele were subjected to stress, in one experiment they were taken from their mothers and raised as orphans, they processed serotonin less efficiently, a risk factor for depression and anxiety, than monkeys with the long allele who endured similar privations. But young monkeys with the same risky genetic profile, who were raised by nurturing mothers, did as well as or better than their long allele brethren, even those raised in similarly secure environments, at key social tasks like finding playmates, building alliances, and handling conflicts. They often became leaders of their troops. They also processed serotonin more efficiently. Stephen Suomi, the scientist who conducted these studies, has speculated that these high-reactive monkeys owed their success to the enormous amounts of time they spent watching rather than participating in the group, absorbing on a deep level the laws of social dynamics. This is a hypothesis that might ring true to parents whose high-reactive children hover observantly on the edges of their peer group, sometimes for weeks or months, before edging successfully inside. Studies in humans have found that adolescent girls with the short allele of the SERT gene are 20% more likely to be depressed than long allele girls when exposed to stressful family environments, but 25% less likely to be depressed when raised in stable homes. Similarly, short allele adults have been shown to have more anxiety in the evening than others when they've had stressful days, but less anxiety on calm days. High-reactive 4-year-olds give more pro-social responses than other children when presented with moral dilemmas, but this difference remains at age 5 only if their mothers used gentle, not harsh, discipline. High-reactive children raised in supportive environments are even more resistant than other kids to the common cold and other respiratory illnesses, but get sick more easily if they're raised in stressful conditions. The short allele of the SERT gene is also associated with higher performance on a wide range of cognitive tasks. These findings are so dramatic that it's remarkable no one arrived at them until recently. Remarkable, but perhaps not surprising. Psychologists are trained to heal, so their research naturally focuses on problems and pathology. It is almost as if, metaphorically speaking, sailors are so busy, and wisely, looking under the waterline for extensions of icebergs that could sink their ship, writes Belsky, that they fail to appreciate that by climbing on top of the iceberg, it might prove possible to chart a clear passage through the ice-laden sea. The parents of high-reactive children are exceedingly lucky, Belsky told me. The time and effort they invest will actually make a difference. Instead of seeing these kids as vulnerable to adversity, parents should see them as malleable, for worse, but also for better. He describes eloquently a high-reactive child's ideal parent, someone who can read your cues and respect your individuality, is warm and firm in placing demands on you without being harsh or hostile, promotes curiosity, academic achievement, delayed gratification, and self-control, and is not harsh, neglectful, or inconsistent. This advice is terrific for all parents, of course, but it's crucial for raising a high-reactive child. If you think your child might be high-reactive, you're probably already asking yourself what else you can do to cultivate your son or daughter. Chapter 11 has some answers. But even orchid children can withstand some adversity, Belsky says. Take divorce. In general, it will disrupt orchid kids more than others. If the parents squabble a lot and put their kid in the middle, then watch out. This is the kid who will succumb. But if the divorcing parents get along, if they provide their child with the other psychological nutrients he needs, then even an orchid child can do just fine. Most people would appreciate the flexibility of this message, I think. Few of us had problem-free childhoods. But there's another kind of flexibility that we all hope applies to the question of who we are and what we become. We want the freedom to map our own destinies. We want to preserve the advantageous aspects of our temperaments and improve or even discard the ones we dislike, such as a horror of public speaking. In addition to our inborn temperaments, beyond the luck of the draw of our childhood experience, we want to believe that we, as adults, can shape ourselves and make what we will of our lives. Can we? Chapter 5. Beyond Temperament. The Role of Free Will and the Secret of Public Speaking for Introverts. Enjoyment appears at the boundary between boredom and anxiety, when the challenges are just balanced with the person's capacity to act. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Deep inside the bowels of the Athenula A. Martino Center for Biomedical Imaging at Massachusetts General Hospital, the hallways are nondescript, dingy even. I'm standing outside the locked door of a windowless room with Dr. Carl Schwartz, the director of the Developmental Neuroimaging and Psychopathology Research Lab. Schwartz has bright, inquisitive eyes, graying brown hair, and a quietly enthusiastic manner. Despite our unprepossessing surroundings, he prepares with some fanfare to unlock the door. The room houses a multi-million-dollar fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, machine, which has made possible some of the greatest breakthroughs in modern neuroscience. An fMRI machine can measure which parts of the brain are active when you're thinking a particular thought or performing a specific task, allowing scientists to perform the once unimaginable task of mapping the functions of the human brain. A principal inventor of the fMRI technique, says Dr. Schwartz, was a brilliant but unassuming scientist named Kenneth Kwong, who works inside this very building. This whole place is full of quiet and modest people doing extraordinary things, Schwartz adds, waving his hand appreciatively at the empty hallway. Before Schwartz opens the door, he asks me to take off my gold hoop earrings and set aside the metal tape recorder I've been using to record our conversation. The magnetic field of the fMRI machine is 100,000 times stronger than the Earth's gravitational pull. So strong, Schwartz says, that it could rip the earrings right out of my ears if they were magnetic, and send them flying across the room. I worry about the metal fasteners of my bra, but I'm too embarrassed to ask. I point instead to my shoe buckle, which I figure has the same amount of metal as the bra strap. Schwartz says it's all right, and we enter the room. We gaze reverently at the fMRI scanner, which looks like a gleaming rocket ship lying on its side. Schwartz explains that he asks his subjects, who are in their late teens, to lie down with their heads in the scanner while they look at photographs of faces and the machine tracks how their brains respond. He's especially interested in activity in the amygdala, the same powerful organ inside the brain that Kagan found played such an important role in shaping some introverts' and extroverts' personalities. Schwartz is Kagan's colleague and protege, and his work picks up just where Kagan's longitudinal studies of personality left off. The infants Kagan once categorized as high and low reactive have now grown up, and Schwartz is using the fMRI machine to peer inside their brains. Kagan followed his subjects from infancy into adolescence, but Schwartz wanted to see what happened to them after that. Would the footprint of temperament be detectable all those years later in the adult brains of Kagan's high and low reactive infants? Or would it have been erased by some combination of environment and conscious effort? Interestingly, Kagan cautioned Schwartz against doing the study. In the competitive field of science research, you don't want to waste time conducting studies that may not yield significant findings. And Kagan worried that there were no results to be found, that the link between temperament and destiny would be severed by the time an infant reached adulthood. "He was trying to take care of me," Schwartz tells me. It was an interesting paradox, because here Jerry was doing all these early observations of infants and seeing that it wasn't just their social behavior that was different in the extremes. Everything about these kids was different. Their eyes dilated more widely when they were solving problems. Their vocal cords became more tense while uttering words. Their heart rate patterns were unique. There were all these channels that suggested there was something different physiologically about these kids, and I think, in spite of this, because of his intellectual heritage, he had the feeling that environmental factors are so complex that it would be really hard to pick up that footprint of temperament later in life. But Schwartz, who believes that he's a high reactive himself and was drawing partly on his own experience, had a hunch that he'd find that footprint even farther along the longitudinal timeline than Kagan had. He demonstrates his research by allowing me to act as if I were one of his subjects, albeit not inside the fMRI scanner. As I sit at a desk, a computer monitor flashes photos at me, one after another, each showing an unfamiliar face. Disembodied black-and-white heads floating against a dark background. I think I can feel my pulse quicken as the photos start coming at me faster and faster. I also notice that Schwartz has slipped in some repeats, and that I feel more relaxed as the faces start to look familiar. I describe my reactions to Schwartz, who nods. "The slideshow is designed," he says, "to mimic an environment that corresponds to the sense that high reactive people get when they walk into a crowded room of strangers and feel, 'Geez, who are these people?'" I wonder if I'm imagining my reactions or exaggerating them, but Schwartz tells me that he's gotten back the first set of data on a group of high reactive children Kagan studied from 4 months of age, and sure enough, the amygdala of those children, now grown up, had turned out to be more sensitive to the pictures of unfamiliar faces than did the amygdala of those who'd been bold toddlers. Both groups reacted to the pictures, but the formerly shy kids reacted more. In other words, the footprint of a high or low reactive temperament never disappeared in adulthood. Some high reactives grew into socially fluid teenagers who were not outwardly rattled by novelty, but they never shed their genetic inheritance. Schwartz's research suggests something important. We can stretch our personalities, but only up to a point. Our inborn temperaments influence us regardless of the lives we lead. A sizable part of who we are is ordained by our genes, by our brains, by our nervous systems. And yet the elasticity that Schwartz found in some of the high reactive teens also suggests the converse. We have free will and can use it to shape our personalities. These seem like contradictory principles, but they're not. Free will can take us far, suggests Dr. Schwartz's research, but it cannot carry us infinitely beyond our genetic limits. Bill Gates is never going to be Bill Clinton, no matter how he polishes his social skills, and Bill Clinton can never be Bill Gates, no matter how much time he spends alone with a computer. We might call this the rubber band theory of personality. We are like rubber bands at rest. We are elastic and can stretch ourselves, but only so much. To understand why this might be so for high reactives, it helps to look at what happens in the brain when we greet a stranger at a cocktail party. Remember that the amygdala, and the limbic system of which it's a key part, is an ancient part of the brain, so old that primitive mammals have their own versions of this system. But as mammals became more complex, an area of the brain called the neocortex developed around the limbic system. The neocortex, and particularly the frontal cortex in humans, performs an astonishing array of functions, from deciding which brand of toothpaste to buy, to planning a meeting, to pondering the nature of reality. One of these functions is to soothe unwarranted fears. If you were a high reactive baby, then your amygdala may, for the rest of your life, go a bit wild every time you introduce yourself to a stranger at a cocktail party. But if you feel relatively skilled in company, that's partly because your frontal cortex is there to tell you to calm down, extend a handshake, and smile. In fact, a recent fMRI study shows that when people use self-talk to reassess upsetting situations, activity in their prefrontal cortex increases in an amount correlated with a decrease of activity in their amygdala. But the frontal cortex isn't all-powerful. It doesn't switch the amygdala off altogether. In one study, scientists conditioned a rat to associate a certain sound with an electrical shock. Then they played that sound over and over again without administering the shock until the rats lost their fear. But it turned out that this unlearning was not as complete as the scientists first thought. When they severed the neural connections between the rat's cortex and the amygdala, the rats became afraid of the sound again. This was because the fear conditioning had been suppressed by the activity of the cortex, but was still present in the amygdala. In humans with unwarranted fears, like batophobia or fear of heights, the same thing happens. Repeated trips to the top of the Empire State Building seem to extinguish the fear, but it may come roaring back during times of stress when the cortex has other things to do than soothe an excitable amygdala. This helps explain why many high reactive kids retain some of the fearful aspects of their temperament all the way into adulthood, no matter how much social experience they acquire or free will they exercise. My colleague Sally is a good example of this phenomenon. Sally is a thoughtful and talented book editor, a self-described shy introvert, and one of the most charming and articulate people I know. If you invite her to a party, and later ask your other guests whom they most enjoyed meeting, chances are they'll mention Sally. She's so sparkly, they'll tell you, so witty, so adorable. Sally is conscious of how well she comes across. You can't be as appealing as she is without being aware of it. But that doesn't mean her amygdala knows it. When she arrives at a party, Sally often wishes she could hide behind the nearest couch until her prefrontal cortex takes over and she remembers what a good conversationalist she is. Even so, her amygdala, with its lifetime of stored associations between strangers and anxiety, sometimes prevails. Sally admits that sometimes she drives an hour to a party and then leaves 5 minutes after arriving. When I think of my own experiences in light of Schwartz's findings, I realize it's not true that I'm no longer shy. I've just learned to talk myself down from the ledge. Thank you, prefrontal cortex. By now, I do it so automatically that I'm hardly aware it's happening. When I talk with a stranger or a group of people, my smile is bright and my manner direct, but there's a split second that feels like I'm stepping onto a high wire. By now, I've had so many thousands of social experiences that I've learned that the high wire is a figment of my imagination, or that I won't die if I fall. I reassure myself so instantaneously that I'm barely aware I'm doing it. But the reassurance process is still happening, and occasionally it doesn't work. The word that Kagan first used to describe high-reactive people was inhibited, and that's exactly how I still feel at some dinner parties. This ability to stretch ourselves within limits applies to extroverts, too. One of my clients, Allison, is a business consultant, mother, and wife with the kind of extroverted personality, friendly, forthright, perpetually on the go, that makes people describe her as a force of nature. She has a happy marriage, 2 daughters she adores, and her own consulting firm that she built from scratch. She's rightly proud of what she's accomplished in life. But she hasn't always felt so satisfied. The year she graduated from high school, she took a good look at herself and didn't like what she saw. Allison is extremely bright, but you couldn't see that from her high school transcript. She'd had her heart set on attending an Ivy League school and had thrown that chance away. And she knew why. She'd spent high school socializing. Allison was involved in practically every extracurricular activity her school had to offer, and that didn't leave much time for academics. Partly she blamed her parents, who were so proud of their daughter's social gifts that they hadn't insisted she study more. But mostly, she blamed herself. As an adult, Allison is determined not to make similar mistakes. She knows how easy it would be to lose herself in a whirl of PTA meetings and business networking. So Allison's solution is to look to her family for adaptive strategies. She happens to be the only child of two introverted parents, to be married to an introvert, and to have a younger daughter who is a strong introvert herself. Allison has found ways to tap into the wavelength of the quiet types around her. When she visits her parents, she finds herself meditating and writing in her journal, just the way her mother does. At home, she relishes peaceful evenings with her homebody husband. And her younger daughter, who enjoys intimate backyard talks with her mother, has Allison spending her afternoons engaged in thoughtful conversation. Allison has even created a network of quiet, reflective friends. Although her best friend in the world, Amy, is a highly charged extrovert just like her, most of her other friends are introverts. "I so appreciate people who listen well," says Allison. "They are the friends I go have coffee with. They give me the most spot-on observations. Sometimes I haven't even realized I was doing something counterproductive, and my introverted friends will say, 'Here's what you're doing, and here are 15 examples of when you did that same thing,' whereas my friend Amy wouldn't even notice. But my introverted friends are sitting back and observing, and we can really connect over that." Allison remains her boisterous self, but she has also discovered how to be and to benefit from quiet. Even though we can reach for the outer limits of our temperaments, it can often be better to situate ourselves squarely inside our comfort zones. Consider the story of my client Esther, a tax lawyer at a large corporate law firm. A tiny brunette with a springy step and blue eyes as bright as headlamps, Esther was not shy and never had been. But she was decidedly introverted. Her favorite part of the day was the quiet 10 minutes when she walked to the bus along the tree-lined streets of her neighborhood. Her second favorite part was when she got to close the door to her office and dig into her work. Esther had chosen her career well. A mathematician's daughter, she loved to think about intimidatingly complex tax problems and could discuss them with ease. In Chapter 7, I examine why introverts are so good at complex, focused problem-solving. She was the youngest member of a close-knit working group operating inside a much larger law firm. This group comprised 5 other tax lawyers, all of whom supported one another's careers. Esther's work consisted of thinking deeply about questions that fascinated her and working closely with trusted colleagues. But it happened that Esther's small group of tax lawyers periodically had to give presentations to the rest of the law firm. These talks were a source of misery for Esther, not because she was afraid of public speaking, but because she wasn't comfortable speaking extemporaneously. Esther's colleagues, in contrast, all of whom happened to be extroverts, were spontaneous talkers who decided what they'd say on their way to the presentation and were somehow able to convey their thoughts intelligibly and engagingly by the time they arrived. Esther was fine if given a chance to prepare, but sometimes her colleagues failed to mention that they'd be delivering a talk until she arrived at work that morning. She assumed that their ability to speak improvisationally was a function of their superior understanding of tax law, and that, as she gained more experience, she too would be able to wing it. But as Esther became more senior and more knowledgeable, she still couldn't do it. To solve Esther's problem, let's focus on another difference between introverts and extroverts, their preference for stimulation. For several decades, beginning in the late 1960s, an influential research psychologist named Hans Eysenck hypothesized that human beings seek just right levels of stimulation, not too much and not too little. Stimulation is the amount of input we have coming in from the outside world. It can take any number of forms, from noise to social life to flashing lights. Eysenck believed that extroverts prefer more stimulation than introverts do, and that this explained many of their differences. Introverts enjoy shutting the doors to their offices and plunging into their work, because for them, this sort of quiet intellectual activity is optimally stimulating, while extroverts function best when engaged in higher wattage activities, like organizing team-building workshops or chairing meetings. Eysenck also thought that the basis of these differences might be found in a brain structure called the ascending reticular activating system, ARIS. The ARIS is a part of the brainstem that has connections leading up to the cerebral cortex and other parts of the brain. The brain has excitatory mechanisms that cause us to feel awake, alert, and energetic, aroused in the parlance of psychologists. It also has calming mechanisms that do the opposite. Eysenck speculated that the ARIS regulates the balance between over and under arousal by controlling the amount of sensory stimulation that flows into the brain. Sometimes the channels are wide open, so a lot of stimulation can get in, and sometimes they're constricted, so the brain is less stimulated. Eysenck thought that the ARIS functioned differently in introverts and extroverts. Introverts have wide-open information channels, causing them to be flooded with stimulation and over-aroused, while extroverts have tighter channels, making them prone to under-arousal. Over-arousal doesn't produce anxiety so much as the sense that you can't think straight, that you've had enough and would like to go home now. Under-arousal is something like cabin fever. Not enough is happening. You feel itchy, restless, and sluggish, like you need to get out of the house already. Today we know that the reality is far more complex. For one thing, the ARIS doesn't turn stimulation on and off like a fire truck's hose, flooding the entire brain at once. Different parts of the brain are aroused more than others at different times. Also, high arousal levels in the brain don't always correlate with how aroused we feel. And there are many different kinds of arousal. Arousal by loud music is not the same as arousal by mortar fire, which is not the same as arousal by presiding at a meeting. You might be more sensitive to one form of stimulation than to another. It's also too simple to say that we always seek moderate levels of arousal. Excited fans at a soccer game crave hyperstimulation, while people who visit spas for relaxation treatments seek low levels. Still, more than 1,000 studies conducted by scientists worldwide have tested Eysenck's theory that cortical arousal levels are an important clue to the nature of introversion and extroversion. And it appears to be what the personality psychologist David Funder calls half-right in very important ways. Whatever the underlying cause, there's a host of evidence that introverts are more sensitive than extroverts to various kinds of stimulation, from coffee to a loud bang to the dull roar of a networking event, and that introverts and extroverts often need very different levels of stimulation to function at their best. In one well-known experiment, dating all the way back to 1967 and still a favorite in-class demonstration in psychology courses, Eysenck placed lemon juice on the tongues of adult introverts and extroverts to find out who salivated more. Sure enough, the introverts, being more aroused by sensory stimuli, were the ones with the watery mouths. In another famous study, introverts and extroverts were asked to play a challenging word game in which they had to learn, through trial and error, the governing principle of the game. While playing, they wore headphones that emitted random bursts of noise. They were asked to adjust the volume of their headsets up or down to the level that was just right. On average, the extroverts chose a noise level of 72 decibels, while the introverts selected only 55 decibels. When working at the volume that they had selected, loud for the extroverts, quiet for the introverts, the two types were about equally aroused, as measured by their heart rates and other indicators. They also played equally well. When the introverts were asked to work at the noise level preferred by the extroverts, and vice versa, everything changed. Not only were the introverts over-aroused by the loud noise, but they also underperformed, taking an average of 9.1 trials rather than 5.8 to learn the game. The opposite was true for the extroverts. They were under-aroused and possibly bored by the quieter conditions and took an average of 7.3 trials compared with the 5.4 they'd averaged under noisier conditions. When combined with Kagan's findings on high reactivity, this line of studies offers a very empowering lens through which to view your personality. Once you understand introversion and extroversion as preferences for certain levels of stimulation, you can begin consciously trying to situate yourself in environments favorable to your own personality, neither overstimulating nor understimulating, neither boring nor anxiety-making. You can organize your life in terms of what personality psychologists call optimal levels of arousal and what I call sweet spots, and by doing so feel more energetic and alive than before. Your sweet spot is the place where you're optimally stimulated. You probably seek it out already without being aware that you're doing so. Imagine that you're lying contentedly in a hammock, reading a great novel. This is a sweet spot. But after half an hour, you realize that you've read the same sentence 5 times. Now you're understimulated. So you call a friend and go out for brunch. In other words, you ratchet up your stimulation level, and as you laugh and gossip over blueberry pancakes, you're back, thank goodness, inside your sweet spot. But this agreeable state lasts only until your friend, an extrovert who needs much more stimulation than you do, persuades you to accompany her to a block party, where you're now confronted by loud music and a sea of strangers. Your friend's neighbors seem affable enough, but you feel pressured to make small talk above the din of music. Now, bang, just like that, you've fallen out of your sweet spot, except this time, you're overstimulated. And you'll probably feel that way until you pair off with someone on the periphery of the party for an in-depth conversation, or bow out altogether and return to your novel. Imagine how much better you'll be at this sweet spot game once you're aware of playing it. You can set up your work, your hobbies, and your social life so that you spend as much time inside your sweet spot as possible. People who are aware of their sweet spots have the power to leave jobs that exhaust them and start new and satisfying businesses. They can hunt for homes based on the temperaments of their family members, with cozy window seats and other nooks and crannies for the introverts, and large, open living dining spaces for the extroverts. Understanding your sweet spot can increase your satisfaction in every arena of your life, but it goes even further than that. Evidence suggests that sweet spots can have life or death consequences. According to a recent study of military personnel conducted through the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, introverts function better than extroverts when sleep-deprived, which is a cortically de-arousing condition. Because losing sleep makes us less alert, active, and energetic. Drowsy extroverts behind the wheel should be especially careful, at least until they increase their arousal levels by chugging coffee or cranking up the radio. Conversely, introverts driving in loud, overly arousing traffic noise should work to stay focused, since the noise may impair their thinking. Now that we know about optimal levels of stimulation, Esther's problem, winging it at the podium, also makes sense. Over-arousal interferes with attention and short-term memory, key components of the ability to speak on the fly. And since public speaking is an inherently stimulating activity, even for those, like Esther, who suffer no stage fright, introverts can find their attention impaired just when they need it most. Esther could live to be a 100-year-old lawyer, in other words, the most knowledgeable practitioner in her field, and she might never be comfortable speaking extemporaneously. She might find herself perpetually unable, at speech time, to draw on the massive body of data sitting inside her long-term memory. But once Esther understands herself, she can insist to her colleagues that they give her advance notice of any speaking events. She can practice her speeches and find herself well inside her sweet spot when finally she reaches the podium. She can prepare the same way for client meetings, networking events, even casual meetings with her colleagues. Any situation of heightened intensity in which her short-term memory and the ability to think on her feet might be a little more compromised than usual. Esther managed to solve her problem from the comfort of her sweet spot. Yet sometimes stretching beyond it is our only choice. Some years ago, I decided that I wanted to conquer my fear of public speaking. After much hemming and hawing, I signed up for a workshop at the Public Speaking Social Anxiety Center of New York. I had my doubts. I felt like a garden-variety shy person, and I didn't like the pathological sound of the term social anxiety. But the class was based on desensitization training, an approach that made sense to me. Often used as a way to conquer phobias, desensitization involves exposing yourself and your amygdala to the thing you're afraid of over and over again in manageable doses. This is very different from the well-meaning but unhelpful advice that you should just jump in at the deep end and try to swim, an approach that might work, but more likely will produce panic, further encoding in your brain a cycle of dread, fear, and shame. I found myself in good company. There were about 15 people in the class, which was led by Charles DeCagno, a wiry, compact man with warm brown eyes and a sophisticated sense of humor. Charles is himself a veteran of exposure therapy. Public speaking anxiety doesn't keep him up at night anymore, he says, but fear is a wily enemy, and he's always working to get the better of it. The workshop had been in session for a few weeks before I joined, but Charles assured me that newcomers were welcome. The group was more diverse than I expected. There was a fashion designer with long curly hair, bright lipstick, and pointy snakeskin boots, a secretary with thick glasses and a clipped matter-of-fact manner who talked a lot about her Mensa membership, a couple of investment bankers, tall and athletic, an actor with black hair and vivid blue eyes who bounded cheerfully across the room in his Puma sneakers but claimed to be terrified the entire time, a Chinese software designer with a sweet smile and a nervous laugh, a regular cross-section of New Yorkers, really. It might have been a class in digital photography or Italian cooking, except that it wasn't. Charles explained that each of us would speak in front of the group, but at an anxiety level we could handle. A martial arts instructor named Letitia was first up that evening. Letitia's assignment was to read aloud to the class from a Robert Frost poem. With her dreadlocks and wide smile, Letitia looked as if she wasn't afraid of anything. But as she got ready to speak, her book propped open at the podium, Charles asked how anxious she was on a scale of 1 to 10. "At least 7," said Letitia. "Take it slow," he said. "There are only a few people out there who can completely overcome their fears, and they all live in Tibet." Letitia read the poem clearly and quietly, with only the slightest tremor in her voice. When she was finished, Charles beamed proudly. "Stand up, please, Lisa," he said, addressing an attractive young marketing director with shiny black hair and a gleaming engagement ring. "It's your turn to offer feedback. Did Letitia look nervous?" "No," said Lisa. "I was really scared, though," Letitia said. "Don't worry, no one could tell," Lisa assured her. The others nodded their heads vigorously. "Couldn't tell at all," they echoed. Letitia sat down, looking pleased. Next it was my turn. I stood at a makeshift podium, really a music stand, and faced the group. The only sound in the room was the ticking of the ceiling fan and the blare of traffic outside. Charles asked me to introduce myself. I took a deep breath. "Hello," I shouted, hoping to sound dynamic. Charles looked alarmed. "Just be yourself," he said. My first exercise was simple. All I had to do was answer a few questions that people called out. "Where do you live? What do you do for a living? What did you do this weekend?" I answered the questions in my normal, soft-spoken way. The group listened carefully. "Does anyone have any more questions for Susan?" asked Charles. The group shook their heads. "Now, Dan," said Charles, nodding at a strapping, red-haired fellow who looked like one of those CNBC journalists reporting directly from the New York Stock Exchange. "You're a banker, and you have tough standards. Tell me, did Susan look nervous?" "Not at all," said Dan. The rest of the group nodded. "Not nervous at all," they murmured, just as they had for Letitia. "You seem so outgoing," they added. "You came across as really confident. You're lucky because you never run out of things to say." I sat down feeling pretty good about myself. But soon I saw that Letitia and I weren't the only ones to get that kind of feedback. A few others did as well. "You looked so calm," these speakers were told, to their visible relief. "No one would ever know if they didn't know. What are you doing in this class?" At first I wondered why I prized these reassurances so highly. Then I realized that I was attending the workshop because I wanted to stretch myself to the outer limits of my temperament. I wanted to be the best and bravest speaker I could be. The reassurances were evidence that I was on my way toward achieving this goal. I suspected that the feedback I was getting was overly charitable, but I didn't care. What mattered